For this program comes from Odagawa Anshell Design Build, devoted to sustainable remodeling and high-level workmanship in the Twin Cities for over 14 years. At the Remodeler Showcase October 1st through the 3rd, odagawa-anshell.com.
Arts reporting on Minnesota Public Radio is supported in part by NPR members and the Minnesota Legacy Amendments Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio News. What makes a school a dropout factory? That's what one education researcher calls them. A high school so dysfunctional, yes, so demoralized, that instead of churning out graduates, it spits students back out onto the streets long before they've gotten their diplomas. Many graduate, fewer than 60% of freshman students within 4 years. And a new report finds that only 47% of young black men are graduating from high school. Many of them are leaving these troubled schools. We talked about it briefly yesterday with filmmaker Davis Guggenheim, but we wanted to devote an hour to it today. Our guests are going to give us their views and the benefit of their experience. I want to hear from your experience in our audience this morning as well. If you're an educator working specifically on this issue, I hope you'll tell us what's working for you to keep students in school. If you dropped out, I'd like to hear why. What happened after you left school? And parents, if you have a child who's thinking about dropping out, tell us about what those discussions sound like in your own home. So if you're an educator involved in this issue, please call us and tell us about your own experience. If you're somebody who did drop out, tell us about what happened after you left school. And parents, if these are the kind of conversations going on in your own household, we'd like to hear about that as well. 800-242-2828. If you're in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, nprnewsq.org. Click on Send Us a Question, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Online today, nprnewsq.org. Our guest this hour, Christopher Swanson, is Vice President of Research at Editorial Projects in Education. And he joins us this morning from Bethesda. And Chris, thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be here, Carrie.
Steve Barr joins us as well. He's founder and chair emeritus of Green Dot Schools. And he's with us today from L.A. And I know it's early there. Steve, thank you so much for being with us.
It's great to be here.
And later in the hour, Rashawn Biddle is going to be with us. He's the editor of Dropout Nation. It's a website that covers American education reform. And Chris Swanson, to you first, you were the primary author of a report that came out earlier this summer on the dropout rate. One of the things that really stood out as I read the report again is how concentrated some of these troubled schools are in some parts of the country. I think you call them epicenters, don't you?
That's right. And one of the things that we have learned over the years is that, you know, first, that the dropout problem is much more severe and widespread than people commonly realize, although I think we're getting a little bit better about facing facts there. But the other piece of that is that even though it's a problem that every community, virtually every school system has to be concerned about, there are certain places where it's just a devastating situation. And because these tend to be some of our largest, you know, most urban districts and communities that enroll a lot of students, when you roll these up to a national level, it's really shocking. You know, just a couple dozen school systems, you know, out of the, you know, 12,000 or so that graduate high school students account for a disproportionate share of the nation's total number of dropouts. And, you know, as you know, you mentioned the work on dropout factories
right.
that Bob Balfans and colleagues have, you know, been doing over the years. They find something similar, but I think when we look at this epicenter analysis, it's even more startling. And I think the reason for concern.
Here's something I wondered about this as well. If you go back into the history of some of these schools and these districts that you call epicenters, will you find that they have experienced a high dropout rate for decades, or is this something fairly new, something different going on?
Well, you know, it's hard to go back too far because one of the things that's been difficult. I've been doing this research for about 8 years, and you know, right after No Child Left Behind came in, was really, you know, in some ways the modern age in terms of looking at the dropout and graduation issue, because historically it had not been part of public accountability systems. If things are not held accountable, they're not measured, and so there was very little information in a systematic way, kind of prior to say, you know, 2003 to 2005. You know, some school systems can track this back over time, and if you were able to, I think in some of these really serious epicenters, this is a really chronic problem. It's been going on for years, if not decades. And it's a culmination of a lot of educational issues, as well as the fact that public schools are very much the reflection of the public and the community they serve.
Hmm.
And so if these are high poverty communities, places with, you know, histories of discrimination and racism and housing, segregation, that, you know, really factor into some fairly dysfunctional aspects of community life that, you know, work themselves into the public schools, it would be no surprise to look back and find out that things have been, you know, pretty bad for years.
Steve Barr, Green Dot Schools comes in to some of these highly dysfunctional schools and turns them around, right?
Well, we have 12 charter schools that are set aside that are just in those neighborhoods where you have a 50, 60, 70% dropout rate. And we were able to go into those same areas and we think take the same kids with a little less money and graduate, you know, 80 to 90% of those same kids, with three-fourths of them going on to four-year universities. 3 years ago, we took over one of the dropout factories hostily with the teachers and acted No Child Left Behind, a school called Locke High School, and with the idea that maybe our model could help in the turnaround of a school. And and there's not many of those examples across the country, and we're just entering our third year of that work.
Tell me what you do. I mean, how do you turn it around? How do you change the culture in a school?
Well, I mean, it used to be, you know, when you always have educators and people on TV talk about the good old days of education in high schools, and I certainly went to great high schools in California that were well-funded. You know, but those schools were only built for 10 or 20% of the kids, and they used to tell me that when I was a kid, you know, 20% you're going to go on and do great things, and 20% of you we can't do anything for. And the vast majority, as long as you can read or write, there's jobs for you. The problem is, you know, 30, 40 years later, we're still running our schools the same way with less dollars, as pension plans have grown and the tax base has left in this city. White and black people have left the public school system. But we're still running the schools the same way when we actually need a totally different type of person in the workforce to be successful. We're still running our schools like they're a manufacturing base. So you have the politically entitled that have left the schools. And now in Los Angeles, over 80% of the people that attend public schools in my city are Latino, and they're not as politically connected.
Mm-hmm.
There's not an emphasis. And then also, you know, my middle class and upper middle class folks, people I live around, we've lost interest, but the interest is coming back because of the economy. We don't have a private school tax in our back pocket. We can barely afford our mortgages. And films like Waiting for Superman, and it seems like over the last 4 or 5 years, the stars are aligning where we're actually really having a national conversation.
As you both know, I asked our audience to weigh in here if we could hear from some parents, perhaps discussions like this going on in their own homes, and maybe some people who have dropped out themselves and what happened. And we have somebody on the line in Minneapolis. Stefano, thanks very much for calling in.
Yeah, sure. How you doing?
Good. What was your experience with it, with dropping out?
You know, I went to high school in Los Angeles at North Hollywood High just after the LA riots in 92. I was actually supposed to graduate, I think, in 94. And what I saw taking place at the school there was that there was these draconian rules for students like me who wrote on the bathroom walls, but there wasn't that draconian support. So when I was told to, you know, leave school, you're suspended, and don't come back without your mother. And in the meantime, my mother was very much not fit to come to a parent-teacher conference. I just dropped out. I ended up hanging out at the Taco Bell across the street for the next year.
Wow.
And I'm now in a PhD program, and I teach geography at the University of Minnesota.
Wow.
Because I got that draconian support along with the institutional rules, which are very much necessary once I went to community college. Because in California, you just have to be 18. You don't need a proficiency or a high school diploma to start community college. So I think I obviously had the potential, and I was okay with abiding by the rules of the institution, but there wasn't the support. There was just the crackdown at places like North Hollywood High. And I also taught at a charter school right before I went off to my master's program at UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the same kind of thing. There were so many rules in place, but I didn't see the support behind the rules, and it was because of lack of funding more than it was lack of concern, but it was also lack of know-how. How do you reach kids who need to be reached in a way other than just implementing rules on their backs?
Steve Barr, tell me what you're thinking as you listen to his experience.
Well, I mean, it's great that he had a second chance there. And I think, you know, in the neighborhoods we serve, these kids, we're undoing 8 years of neglect. That's kind of the business we're in, since we only do high schools to date. But really what it comes down to, when I started Green Dot, I just said, you know, I looked at some of the schools like North Hollywood and schools in East L.A., high schools, and you just, putting a fresh eye on it, I don't think you even need a fresh eye, they just look like prisons. They were built in California for those schools for 1,500 kids, and we didn't build a school for 30 years, and while people fled, we put more and more kids on top of each other, you know, and we had year-round schools, and you have 3,000 or 4,000 kids right on top of each other, and then you have, you know, the result is you're producing prisoners. And so I looked at schools that rich people sent their kids in L.A. There seemed to be a lot of rich people in this town. And what does 25 or 30 grand get you? Well, you would never spend 30 grand on a high school that had 3,000 or 4,000 kids. It had to have 300 or 400 or 500 kids. Why? Because you don't want your kids to fall through the cracks. You would never spend that kind of money on a private school. It was varied expectations, you know, based on skin color or shyness or tracking. You'd have high expectations for all the kids. That's what you're getting paid for. And if my kid's behind, get him up to speed. And if I spent 25 grand and I found out that half the money, that tuition, went to some building downtown where the decisions are really made that I don't have access to, you would never invest in such a school. You want all the money in the classroom to have the highest paid teachers with the best tools. And then for 25 grand, I want to be part of the community. I want to go to the hootenannies and the throwdowns and the fundraisers and the, and I want to walk my kid to school, and I want to know, actually get to know the teachers, and I want to be assured that all the teachers that are in front of my kids think that my kid can learn and will do everything they can to get them into college and all that. So if that works for the richest people, that became kind of the Green Dot model. Why don't public schools look like that? The problem is you've got a huge bureaucracy in school systems. It's a bit of a jobs act. And then you have a lot of really talented people that aren't nurtured when they come into the system, so they leave early. You know, we have teachers that leave in the first and second grade. And we tried to approach that and attack that, and I think we made a lot of headway. The great thing in Waiting for Superman and the great thing that's going across this country is, unlike 30 years ago or 20 years ago when the young man was just on the phone, we didn't have any proof that black and brown kids could learn. It was just, oh, isn't that a shame? Or, you know. Now we have that. Now we have that data. We have those results. They're not just charter schools, but there's really good public schools that do it. Now we got to create the political will to scale those things up.
Steve Barr is one of our guests this morning. He's the founder and chair emeritus of Green Dot Schools, as we talk about the dropout rate. Christopher Swanson is also with us. He's vice president of research at Editorial Projects in Education. Let me go back to the phones. I think we have a principal on the line. Bill in Plymouth, you're a principal of a couple of schools.
I'm a principal of two contract alternative high schools, mm-hmm. and we actually have a contract with the Minneapolis Public Schools to run alternative high schools, which are small settings serving predominantly in 99% free and reduced lunch, mostly African American, with a few Latinos, Native, and some white kids. And the dropout, I'm going to speak specifically about Minneapolis, which I know best.
Sure.
In Minneapolis, we graduate a third of African-American kids who start high school. My experience has been that most of the students who come to us as ninth graders are 4 to 5 years behind in reading skills, more than that in math. I like to say can't write at all.
Wow.
And as high school students, these students are aware that they're behind. And so there are very low expectations that's been set from them from K through 8. Their deficits are not recognized and their assets are not appreciated. And so you've got very low expectations for these students. And then when they get to high school, they have no confidence. They know they can't read. They know they're not able to solve math problems. And so getting them able to have some confidence, beginning to deal with what the district likes to call acceleration in order to get them to caught up is a humongous job. But it is happening in very small schools like the ones we raise, we're operating. But it requires an humongous effort. We need more time in the classroom. We need extended day. Some of the things that the president is calling for. We need massive reform in public education today. As one of your guests have just suggested, we need reform.
Bill, I really appreciate the call, and I want to put some of what you said to Chris Swanson. Chris, what does the research tell us about the factor of these students, as Bill was just telling us, who get to ninth grade and they're all and they're still only reading at a fourth grade level. I mean, how does that contribute to who ends up dropping out?
Yeah, there's a lot of debate over the dropout issue, but one of the things where there's very little debate is that academic preparation coming into high school is probably one of the leading determinants of whether somebody succeeds or fails once they get to high school. And I think what we see too often is historically underserved populations, like minorities or poor kids, they're not getting that good elementary and middle school education all the way along. And this is something that's been known forever, that, you know, poor kids, when they start school, even in kindergarten, are way behind their more affluent peers. And that, you know, gap, unfortunately, does not close as the students get older and work their way through the grades. And by the time you get to ninth grade, when you're entering high school, and our research has shown that it's that ninth grade year that's really critical. That's the biggest source of loss from our high schools.
Really?
You're not prepared academically to do high school level work, and you know the way that the schools work changes. You're in a much bigger environment. There's a lot more choices. You have to start accumulating your credits and actually passing your classes and passing exams in a lot of states and districts in order to be promoted or at least, you know, to be able to qualify to earn a diploma. And so if you start off behind and there's not that kind of intensive support and not the kind of investment and not the kind of expectation for all the students, then the further you fall behind, the further and further away that goal of earning a diploma seems, and the more likely you become to drop out. And that's a huge problem.
We are talking, if you have just tuned in this morning, about why kids drop out, what's going on inside some of these schools that have an excessively high dropout rate. And I'm asking you, if you've tuned in, if you're an educator and you're dealing with this, love to hear about your experience. If you're someone who has dropped out, tell us about what happened after you dropped out. And if you're a parent and you're dealing with this in your own household, we'd like to hear that experience as well, if you'd share that with us. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, mprnewsq.org. If you're streaming us this morning, you're getting a busy signal as you're trying to call in, you can always reach us online, mprnewsq.org. To James in Minneapolis. Hi, James. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, hi. I am in a teacher training program at the moment, but I've spent the last decade being an educator, an arts educator, using the arts to educate about social issues. Mm-hmm. And I was part of a company that would provide extremely hands-on practical training for each moment that an educator might encounter in the classroom, just due to the fact that for the most part, we were working with people who didn't have an education background. I'm going through a formal teacher educator program right now, and a lot of what I'm hearing your guests say echoes what I'm reading in the text that we're reading. However, one of the things that disappoints me is the fact that so many teacher training programs don't focus upon those individual moments of interaction with students.
Mm-hmm.
There is very little discussion about classroom management strategies that work, not just in terms of theory, but in terms of the actual language that you use, the actual moments that you have to navigate. And so I guess I would echo what the previous caller, Stefano, had to say. Because a lot of these, as we're calling them, dropout factories, tend to attract brand new teachers as opposed to teachers who are experienced, who have spent their time in the field and thus have gotten transferred to some school that they for some reason see as more desirable. These new teachers are ill-equipped to deal with the students that they are working with because they have never practiced those specific moments that they know that they'll have to work with.
Steve Barr, you think that's true?
It is in the traditional sense, and there's a lot of resistance in many, many fronts. It's in our schools. And the caller is perfectly dead on. It is about, you know, you have to break this down to the view of a 15-year-old. You know, when I was 15, I used to look at the teacher in front of me and say, geez, when did this person forget what it's like to be 15? Or if I walked into a place that wasn't prepared, your BS meter is so finely tuned at that age, probably ad nauseum, right?
Right.
And so you know when people are looking down at you. You know when the teacher's mailing it in. And so our teachers, first of all, that interaction, of course, is important. You know, there's that adult, you know, need for kids to have somebody besides your parents tell you how great you are is so important. But in our schools, the principals are not people that sit in their offices and deal with discipline issues. They're Phil Jackson. They're coaches. They're in there in the classroom every day coaching. We have master teachers and peer teachers because we all want to get better every day, and we use data, the data that's set aside and approved by the teachers and us through our collective bargaining agreement, which is, I think, a breakthrough collective bargaining agreement.
You do have teachers' unions, though, in Green Dot, right?
We have our own teachers' union, and we have contracts with the American Federation of Teachers and the NEA that states that we have cause instead of tenure. You don't work minutes and hours in a day. It's a professional work day, so you're expected to work an extended day. Teacher performance is part of your evaluation. But we pay the teachers more. They have a little bit more say in what goes on in front of them, and the school is manageable, so we improve their work conditions so they can have that interaction with young people. I think that's the future of unionism. But right now what happens is we all set into our tribes and start yelling at each other when there are breakthrough opportunities out there, and we need to scale those up as well.
Chris online here from Tammy in Minneapolis. She says, I work at Blue Sky Online. It's an online charter school. We've had lots of success with getting dropouts to graduate. Is there any research on this?
You know, that's a great question. There's a couple questions that we often get in doing our work that we can't answer very well. One is, you know, how are special ed students and English language learners doing? There's very little good data on that. And the other area, unfortunately, where there is very little information on graduation rates is charter schools. Charter schools are public schools. They generally operate independently, by and large, of the public school bureaucracy. You know, they're typically, you know, organized on paper as school districts, local education agencies. And although in theory there should be lots of information about these schools in the databases that researchers like me use, in fact, there tends to be very little. And so it's really hard to make any general conclusions about how charter schools are doing compared to traditional public schools when it comes to graduating. Now, hopefully that'll change over time as, you know, we get more and more mature and sophisticated about using our data. But what we know from other research on charter schools, and, you know, only some charter schools would actually graduate students, depending on what their grade spans are, is that there are some very good charter schools out there. There are some charter schools that are really struggling, and there are a lot in the middle. Mm. And whether, you know, charter schools, you know, have that secret sauce or, you know, whatever, you know, that, you know, great strategy is or not, some might have it, some might not. But I think the real question is we need to keep an eye on the innovation that is going on in the charter sector, because there will be lessons to be learned. They can be more nimble, and they do have more freedom to innovate and try things that, you know, maybe haven't been tried before in traditional public schools or just can't be tried because of the way they're run.
Steve Barr, before we take this next call, I did want to hone in here for a minute on this 47% high school graduation rate of young black men, new reports saying that. Is what you're doing in Green Dot enough to address that, or is that going to require yet more and more innovative intervention?
Yeah, I mean, we're just scratching the surface, but we're showing promise, you know. And it's and Christopher's right. It's not, we shouldn't scale up just what charter schools are doing. I mean, when I hang up the phone here, I'm going to take my 5-year-old daughter Zofia to a great LAUSD school. But again, it's 350 kids, it's diverse, the parents are welcome, and they have the highest expectations. So I want every school in my neighborhood to look like that public school, not necessarily any charter school. Mm. And so we have to have the same kind of vigor in black neighborhoods and Latino neighborhoods. I mean, it's the good news is, you know, when I got into this, I had to challenge all my preconditioning, despite the fact that I'm an engaged liberal. I still did not spend a lot of time over there. And guess what? Black families care about their kids' education and want this. Latino families definitely do it. That's why they risked everything to come here. White people want it. It's just, you know, we got to get out of our tribes and gather together and create demand for not charter schools or voucher schools or private schools, but great public schools that have these basic tenets of small with high expectations with the dollars are spent well, and everybody's subservient to the parents and the kids.
You know, that's something that Davis made a point of yesterday when we were talking about his film, that when you look at research on the aspirational level of parents, all parents, for their kids, it is not different depending on what neighborhood you come from or what race you are or what your income level you are. Everybody wants their kids to succeed.
Yeah, and then when we get results, people go, well, you know, you got those certain parents. What does that mean, those certain parents? I mean, if you serve a predominantly Latino neighborhood like we do in East L.A., people just risk everything to come to this country. They didn't come here for a warm ticker tape parade and warm welcoming and high-end jobs. They came here to do jobs none of us want to do, and they came here for their kids. So They want only the best for them, and they'll do anything at a school if you invite them in and include them.
Sounds like you've got a carpool to get to. Steve, thanks very much. We really appreciate the time this morning.
Anytime. Thank you.
Steve Barr is founder and chair emeritus of Green Dot Schools. He was with us this morning from L.A. Christopher Swanson continues with us, vice president of research at Editorial Projects in Education. And Rashawn Biddle is going to join us now. He's a journalist who reported for a long time on dropout issues in the Indianapolis public schools, now writes, covers a website here that covers American education reform. Don't hang up. If you're holding with us, I want to hear your experience. If you're in education, if you've had some experience yourself of considering dropping out, if this is an issue that has come up in your own home, do want to hear from you. I realize we have full phone lines, and we will get right back to the calls as quickly as we can on the other side of news.
Programming is supported by University of Minnesota AmPlatch Children's Hospital, where children who have common or complex health conditions benefit from the latest medical research and innovations. You can learn more at uofmchildrenshospital.org.
Support for this program comes from the University of Wisconsin River Falls, 30 minutes from St. Paul in a small town, offering big opportunities. uwrf.edu. University of Wisconsin River Falls. Work together, stand apart.
On the next All Things Considered, we'll bring you the most important news from around Minnesota and the world and provide the context you expect on the stories that affect your life. I'm Tom Grant. Join me here on Minnesota Public Radio News, weekdays 3 to 6:30.
From Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm Phil Picardi. First-time claims for unemployment benefits dropped more than expected last month. The Labor Department says first-time claims fell to 453,000. That's better than forecast. Meanwhile, rates on 30-year mortgages match the lowest level in decades. Mortgage buyer Freddie Mac says the average rate for 30-year fixed loans fell to 4.32%. That's the lowest on record dating back to 1971. One of the financial companies hardest hit by the credit crisis says it's reached a deal to repay billions of dollars it received in bailout money. AIG received the largest bailout package the government doled out, as much as $180 billion. The U.S. Treasury will swap debt it currently holds in AIG for common stock and then sell those shares over time. Actress Jamie Lee Curtis says her father left behind a legacy of great performances in the movies. Tony Curtis, who starred in films including Some Like It Hot and Sweet Smell of Success, died yesterday of cardiac arrest in Las Vegas. Tony Curtis was 85 years old. It's a soggy Thursday for several eastern states. A storm system moving up the East Coast is prompting worries of flooding and tornadoes. In Wilmington, North Carolina, forecasters say nearly 21 inches of rain has fallen since Sunday. There are flash flood warnings in eastern Virginia and flood watches for Maryland, West Virginia, and Washington, D.C. An Anoka County judge yesterday ruled a convicted kidnapper and killer should be committed to the state's sex offender program if he's released from prison. The judge ruled Ming Sen Shu meets the legal criteria for indefinite commitment. Shu was convicted 30 years ago of kidnapping a former teacher and her 8-year-old daughter and killing a 6-year-old boy who witnessed that kidnapping. Partly cloudy to mostly sunny skies across the state today. High temperatures in the low 60s to near 70 degrees. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
We're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio News, and I'm Carrie Miller. Two big events to tell you about. Tonight, I'm going to be at the Westminster Town Hall Forum with author and filmmaker Mary McDonough Murphy. She is out with a new film and a book on the celebration of 50 years since the publication of To Kill a Mockingbird. The book is excellent. I've not had a chance to see the film yet. I don't think it's out, but we're going to talk about that as well. It is free and open to the public. Be great to see you in the audience at 7 o'clock tonight, free. Come one, come all. Should be an excellent conversation. We are going to broadcast. If you can't make it tonight, we're going to broadcast it next week. But I would love to see you in the audience for the Westminster Town Hall Forum conversation on Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. And then next Tuesday, Minnesota Public Radio News is going to turn this debate about education kind of on its head. Instead of talking about what's wrong with the education system, they're going to zero in on an issue here about teachers who get it right. You can be in the studio audience, especially if you're a teacher, administrator, student, or parent. That is Tuesday, October 5th at 7 o'clock in the UBS Forum. You can go to nprnewsq.org and click on events to reserve your seat. Back to our conversation today, we're talking about the dropout rate. What's going on in schools, some of which have become known as dropout factories? Chris Swenson, Swanson continues with us. He's vice president of research at Editorial Projects in Education. We're bringing Rashawn Biddle into the discussion. He's the editor of Dropout Nation. It's a website that covers American education reform. And Rashawn, it's good to have you join our conversation now.
Oh, great. It's great to join you on this conversation.
You got interested in this when you were covering education issues in Indianapolis, and you started asking questions about the graduation rate in those public schools. Is that right?
Exactly. And the editorial page editor at The Star and I at the time had looked, and, you know, the first thing we asked Indianapolis public schools was, do you know where your kids go after high school? Essentially, you know, do they go to college? Do they go on to job and career? Are they dropping out, et cetera? And the answer that they had was distressing, which is they didn't know. And this was purely distressing because at the end of the day, if the school district doesn't know where the kids are going, then you know you have a problem. You know that the kids are going to places where they don't need to go, both in their, for their economic lives and in their careers, and ultimately they'll land in prison or they'll land in poverty.
What tell me what you found out, what you learned about who these kids are that are making decisions to drop out. I would bet the profile is not always what we'd expect.
Exactly. I mean, the reality is that we think of dropouts as being troublemakers. Mm. You know, the kid who smokes cigarettes or, you know, commits all kinds of offenses and gets suspended constantly. And there are a lot of kids who get suspended who are dropping out of school. That's true. But I often make this point. I was both the honor student and the troublemaker when I was in high school. I got suspended twice in my academic career. And let me tell you something. I graduated. Mm. So that doesn't tell you anything. On the other side, what you see mostly with kids who are dropping out are kids who they're dropping out. They're quiet kids. They're kids you don't always see. They're the kids that aren't necessarily in the troublemaker crowd. They're kids. They're kids who are from early on. They haven't learned how to read, or their reading skills are at a very low level. They get passed on through the K-12 system up to high school. Basically just passed along, even though they're academically failing. And we know this because Robert Balfans, who has done research on these issues.
We've talked about him.
And he made this huge point, which is if you look at a kid who is failing sixth grade math, if you're a sixth grader and you're failing math, you basically have a 1 in 8 to about a 1 in 10 chance of graduating 6 years later.
Hmm.
Well, you know, that leads to a bigger issue, which is reason why sixth grade math is so big and such a huge factor is because at that point you're starting to do word problems, you're starting to get into some really abstract thinking, and you have to build up to that, which means that includes having had good reading skills in order to be able to do word problems. As I like to say to folks, if you got a kid who can't read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is considered an eighth grade book, well, chances are he's not going to be able to do algebra or word problems either.
We have a lot of callers on the line here, and I want to give them a chance to talk with our guests this morning. If you've just tuned in, we're talking about the dropout rate. What's going on with kids who are making that decision to leave high school? What's going on inside those schools? If you're an educator and you've had some experience with this, I hope we hear from you this morning. If you're a parent and there's a discussion like this going on in your household, and if you're somebody who's dropped out, tell us what happened after that. To the phones, to Charlie in Duluth. And Charlie, I know you've been waiting. Thanks so much. Hi, Charlie, are you there? Oh, no. After all that, I think we lost him. Let's try to go to Greg here in St. Paul. Hi, Greg. Thank you very much for waiting. What did you want to add to this?
The last speaker's comments are pivotal to what I'm about to say to the audience. the American public school was designed somewhere around the beginning of the 20th century and has not changed one iota. It's incredible to think that a 21st century child would be interested in the same types of things that a 19th century child would be competent in dealing with. To be specific, public schools don't teach children how to learn. They teach children what to learn. And as long as they are measuring how much children have acquired rather than their capacity to learn, schools will essentially fail children.
You know, this kind of this gets to exactly what Rashawn was saying about critical thinking, doesn't it?
Absolutely. But there are no courses, never mind what the courses are, never mind the capacity of teachers. To look at teachers is to measure dropout rates by the number of teachers that are doing failing or succeeding is idiotic. If one half of all the children are dropping out of school, it has nothing to do with the quality of the teachers. It has something to do with the system of education. That's the big failure.
Let me see if our guests agree with that. And Chris Swanson, I'll go to you first on that.
Well, I think there is some truth to it. You know, one of the things that we've heard, you know, over the past few years is that, you know, we have a, you know, at best early 20th century, maybe 19th century model for high schools. And it involves, you know, people, you know, have the analogy to a factory. You know, students come in, they're the raw material, you know, teachers do some work to them, and they come out, you know, kind of conveyor belt mass production style, you know, and whether that ever worked, you know, or not, I think is a valid question. But I think one of the kind of larger things that we've seen over this period of time is just the dramatic changes in what the mission of public education, especially at the secondary or high school level, is. You know, if you and one in our Diplomas Count report, which is an issue of Education Week from June, we had this very interesting graph that we put together that basically looked at the high school graduation rate from the 1870s all the way to the present day. And one of the things that's striking, and I think it's good to remind people about it, in the early 20th century, there were really only very few people who were finishing high school education, maybe 5%, you know, in the first decade or two of the century. Mm-hmm. And that didn't really dramatically increase until the 30s and 40s and then continued on after World War II. And so as more people engaged in high school education, they were encountering this institution that was built for a different time, for a more elite type of population, for a different type of knowledge and a different type of curriculum. And institutions change very slowly, if at all. And I think, you know, we've had kind of groaning and creaking changes periodically over time. We've gone from kind of an elite model to, you know, a shopping mall high school that was had all kinds of options but was very tracked and stratified. You had your college prep, you had your Votech, you had your general kind of in the middle, you know, and then kind of that is out of fashion for good reason. And now the expectation, at least, you know, when people talk about this publicly, is that all students should be getting a great education that prepares them for college and career, college and work, is the phrase people use a lot. But I think it's a really important question about whether the institution, you know, has caught up in a way that allows every student to really have access to that education. And it's not just delivering tidbits of knowledge or, you know, obscure facts. It is really more and more this matter of kind of how we think, how we problem solve. Critical thinking is as good a way to describe this as any, because that's what's really valuable, not in the 19th or 20th century, but in the 21st century.
I want to come back to this. I hear what Greg is saying, Rashawn, about the institution. When you've got numbers like that, there's something wrong through the institution. But Rashawn, you also know, as this debate gets re-energized here on public education, there's a lot of focus on the quality of teachers. And, I mean, I think the researchers will also tell you that is key to the kind of success that a kid will have in the classroom.
Exactly. And to put it this way, Vicki Phillips, the head of education initiatives at the Gates Foundation, made this point a couple of months ago, which is if you can't change the culture of classrooms and the culture of education until you change what happens in classrooms. And that involves teachers, and that involves students. And it really does involve teachers, because ultimately it is about teacher quality as much as it is about curriculum and all these other factors. And believe me, there's a lot to be said for reforming American public education. not just, you know, what kind of schools we have, but in what kind of delivery models we have, but even whether we continue to have school districts as they currently exist, because honestly, school districts are ineffective in teaching and in providing education to kids. They're ineffective and inefficient in using taxpayer dollars. They're just, honestly, it's basically we're using the old GM system to serve in the 21st century. And honestly, we've seen what GM looks like today. It's still not very successful and what have you. But we ultimately have to look at the teachers. And we have to also look at the systems that train teachers, because it's not just the fault of the teachers. If you look at how teachers are trained, they're trained poorly to handle a lot of these issues, even just basic issues such as teaching kids how to read. The National Council on Teacher Quality, for example, did a survey of 77 schools of education. And out of those 77 schools, only 11 of them that stacked up well in terms of teaching teachers how to teach reading. Now, to understand this, how important reading is to making sure that kids graduate and don't drop out, by the third grade, you know, if a kid has not learned how to read, you start seeing problems such as attention problems and also, all sorts of behavioral issues. And those manifest because of the fact that the kid can't read. Kids, after all, don't know how to respond to things. So what they do is they act out.
Let me, you're talking specifically, Rashawn, about teaching teachers, and we have a teacher in training on the line, and I want to hear what he has to say about some of what you're saying. Dan?
Well, hi. Yeah, hi. I'm actually kind of a non-traditional type of teacher in training. I'm 40 years old. I've gone back to school to become a teacher. And I have to say that a lot of what we're being taught, and I'm going back through I'm doing elementary education, K through eighth grade, and basically, I'd say a good third, if not more, of what we're being taught is the critical thinking component. I mean, I agree that, yes, the model has been in place for a long time, but I have to say, for saying it's an antiquated system, that's really what I'm being pushed, and I'm wondering, in regards to the last caller's comments as far as teaching kids how to think, we're being taught to be critical thinkers. That's, like I said, one of the major components I'm getting from my training recently. And I think, I don't know what the guest thinks about that, but perhaps adding some sort of required critical thinking component to a child's education or part of the curriculum. Of course, there's difficult ways to measure that, but I think that would be an important thing to add. But also at the same time, I just want to make my comments. I think I take a little bit of umbrage, is maybe a strong word, but I think that teachers are being focused towards that model of teaching kids how to think. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's my comments for now.
Okay.
So, thank
thanks,
you.
Dan. Rashawn, what would you say to what he has said about they're learning critical thinking and they're trying to pass that quality on to or teach kids how to do that?
Well, everybody has an exception. And I say, you know, there are always exceptions to the rule, but we've had this discussion about teacher quality for the past 15 years. And it's really intensified in the last 7 or 8 years. And what we've found, again, is ultimately we have a system in which teachers are not being trained well. And then, of course, once we have teachers who aren't being trained well, once they get into education, into classrooms, it's hard to remove a teacher.
Yes.
I mean, it's about, you know, a teacher can gain tenure in 3 years. And it is near lifetime employment. Now, people will say, well, there's process, there's only due process. But ultimately, it's hard for a school district to remove a teacher. And so you have to have a system that better trains teachers. And you have to have a system that basically, I would say, gives teachers more incentives to be better at their jobs. And
all
I'm
right.
not just talking about merit pay or anything of that nature, because that's sort of part of it. There are a lot of great teachers out there, aspiring teachers who are young, in their 20s and in their 30s, who would love to, for example, start schools because they're focusing on these issues and they realize that what they do in their classrooms alone isn't going to be enough.
Let me.
And we don't provide any incentives for them to do that kind of activity on a mass scale.
Rashawn, let me invite some listeners in here, and if you have just tuned in, we are talking about the dropout rate, what happens within schools where there are high dropout rates. What do we know about why kids make a decision to drop out? I'm asking you as you listen in, if you're an educator involved in these issues, you can join the conversation. If you're a parent and you've been dealing with some of this in your own household, be interesting to hear your experience. And at the beginning of the show, we heard from a listener who actually dropped out and is now in a PhD program. But he told us about what created that decision-making to leave high school. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Online at nprnewsq.org to John in Bemidji. Hi, John.
Yes, hi. My name is John, and I'm from Bemidji area, and I work with a program called Project Graduate, where our goal is to help school districts graduate 100% of our students. 2 points I'd like to make in terms of this program. Number one is that we believe in direct intervention. That is, if we can identify a student that is a potential dropout, we intervene right now. And we give that student 16 hours of classroom work where they receive one high school credit and one college credit. And the basis of that class is to help this student decide that it is not a good idea to drop out of school and that it is a very good idea to stay in school and go on to college. And then the second point that I'd like to make is that when a student drops out of school, let's say the student is a sophomore, a junior, or a senior, that school district is losing between $8,000 and $12,000. So it just behooves a school district to work with these students. And one of the reasons why school districts are having a hard time with their money is because these kids are dropping out of school and they're not getting that no state aid. So,
John, if your goal is 100% graduating seniors, where are you at on that scale right now?
Well, first of all, isn't that a great goal? Wouldn't it be neat if every school district in the state of Minnesota said that we're going to graduate 100% of our seniors?
It would.
So for our for the students that I worked with in the past 2 years, at least 90% of those students have decided to stay in school and graduate, and that's a pretty good graduation rate because with the students that I work with, they're also Native American students. They're kids that have a lot of issues. They're students that probably would have dropped out of school had not been for Project Graduate, and so we're delighted in the results that we're getting, and our goal is now is just to train teachers to do what I've been doing for the last 2 years.
I wish you well with the program, John. Thank you so much for the details
you.
On it. Thanks for calling. Christopher Swanson, I did want to ask you about, I was reading yesterday about a program that I think started in Philadelphia, now has been picked up in some other school districts like Chicago, where they undertake an intervention for a student in fifth or sixth grade. If they feel like these are kids at risk for, you know, that they've fallen behind, that these might be the kids that are not going to finish high school, they intervene very early. Are there some other districts experimenting with that? And what do we know about how successful that is?
This is probably one of the more promising trends we've seen on the dropout issue in recent years. And, you know, people talk about this usually in terms of developing early warning systems. And one of the things that the work in Philadelphia, which was done in collaboration with researchers at Johns Hopkins, as well as work that was also going on in Chicago at the consortium there, you know, you can tell really early kind of who's going to be at risk. And it's things, you know, and some of these have been mentioned already. It's, you know, kind of effort in school in the elementary grades. It's behavioral problems. It's attendance. It's grades in your courses, of course. And as early as the elementary grades, you can start predicting, unfortunately, for a lot of kids, you know, what their ultimate path through high school is going to be and the fact that a lot of them will not go on to graduate. And, you know, this is, I think, something that's intrigued a lot of people. It was seen initially as something that was kind of really neat and really sophisticated, and there's some good research backing it up. But one of the other trends that we've seen is just, you know, a movement to upgrade the quality of, you know, district and particularly state data systems. So we just have a lot more information on our students now, and we can follow them over time much better than we could before. And so this type of approach, I think, is within reach of a lot of places now where it wasn't 5 years ago because there is a lot more information. And I think Philadelphia in particular is a great example to point to because what they did They didn't just dive into the data and, you know, crunch some numbers just for the heck of it. They, you know, paired what they learned from that analysis and that deep engagement with data with specific strategies. And one of the key insights, and it's a basic one, but it's something that you don't know necessarily until you look at the data, is that they had a couple different types, major types of dropouts. There were some that were overage with just a couple credits to go to earn a diploma. There were some that were overage with very few credits, or some that were, you know, at age but falling behind, and so forth. And what they did was they, you know, were able to better identify these students early and tailor particular interventions that met them where they were. So if you're a student who's overage and has a couple, just a couple credits shy of a diploma, you know, something like a rapid credit recovery program, weekend or evening school may do the trick. You know, you get them back in, you get those couple credits, and, you know, then they're able to kind of go on, you know, ideally to more education after that. And I think that's, you know, the real moral to the story. You need to know your data, and I think the work Rashawn and his colleagues did in Indianapolis was extremely influential for the state and was a real kind of good example nationwide, because what it taught you is that until you look at your data, you're basically stumbling around in the dark, and you need to know what's going on and then really take action based on that information.
Chris, I appreciate you joining us this morning for the conversation. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Christopher Swanson, Vice President of Research at Editorial Projects in Education. Dariush in Chaska, I'm going to give you the last word on this, if you can be brief.
Yes, I wanted to say that I have listened to all these. I think you are defining a problem in the wrong way, and you're measuring it in the wrong way, and people have done this for many years. You have not gone anywhere. The problem in business, we never fire the employees because product is bad, product being the students. We always fire the CEO and the management. Everybody picks on the teachers. It's not the teacher problem. It's the, how the schools are managed.
All right.
If you look at
I apologize. I'm very short on time. I want to give Rashawn just a quick moment to respond to that, but I thank you for the call. Rashawn, please make it brief.
Well, all I'll say is this. It's a systemic issue, and you need to do a whole lot of systemics, create a whole bunch of systemic solutions from teaching, training teachers to curriculum to actually how we engage parents. And that's, you have to take it on as a real systemic problem and deal with it heads on as a revolution, not an evolution.
And top to bottom, I think I hear you saying.
Exactly.
Rashawn, thank you. Thanks for interrupting the trip to Mexico to join us this morning. We appreciate it.
Hey, not a problem.
Rashawn Biddle is the editor of Dropout Nation. It's a website that covers American education reform. Now, if you missed our conversation yesterday with filmmaker Davis Guggenheim, he's participating and I'm saying really re-energizing this conversation about public education with this new film, Waiting for Superman. Saw it a week or so ago. He was in the studio yesterday. We talked about some of the elements that he put into the film and some of the disagreements, some of the controversy that has erupted because of this film. So if you miss that and you're interested in education issues, you can find it in the archives, nprnewsq.org. Look for it in the mid-morning archives there. Hey, I hope I see you tonight at the Westminster Town Hall Forum. We're talking about 50 years since the publication of To Kill a Mockingbird. It's free and open to the public. This is Mid-Morning.
Each weekday, Minnesota Public Radio News invites you to join the conversation on nprnewsq.org. A new drug can add 4 months to the lives of men suffering from incurable prostate cancer, but it costs $93,000. Today's question, would you pay $93,000 for 4 months of life? Go to nprnewsq.org to leave your answer and see the answers of others, or send a text to 677-677. We'll share some of your answers this afternoon on All Things Considered.